This is Robert Siegel, and welcome to Intelligence Squared US. Intelligence Squared is a series of Oxford-style debates. The tradition of Oxford-style debate has a long and healthy history in Britain. The Intelligence Squared series began as a series of live events in London, and it was imported by the Rosencrantz Foundation. On September 27th, at the inauguration of this series at New York's Asia Society, the Foundation's chairman, Robert Rosencrantz, presented the lofty goal of this endeavor.
We're trying to raise the level of public discourse in American life. We want to promote a civil society in America that is truly civil, where we increase our respect for opposing views, we reduce our anger and emotion, and we call on the best within ourselves as we confront the challenging issues of our day.
Before we begin, a few words about the format. We have two teams of three speakers. Each speaker has 8 minutes in which to make his or her case. Beginning with the proposers, speakers alternate by side until all have spoken. Following the speeches, I, as the moderator, will bring in questions from the audience, and we conclude by allowing each speaker a 2-minute rebuttal. Please note that in this broadcast, you will hear only excerpts of the full speeches. You can download a full audio version of this debate and learn more about the Intelligence Squared debate series at our website, npr.org/Mideast. Now, the speakers for each side. First, those proposing the resolution that we must tolerate a nuclear Iran. George Perkovich is a U.S. foreign policy expert and vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Sanam Vakil is assistant professor of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. And Karim Sajadpour, formerly based in Tehran, is a writer and Iran analyst for the International Crisis Group. Opposing the motion are Patrick Clawson, who is an author and also deputy director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Ruel Marc Gerecht, an expert in Middle East affairs, formerly with the CIA. He's currently a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research, and William Crystal, best-selling author and co-founder editor of the Washington-based political magazine The Weekly Standard. Now, for a bit of context, before the debate, the audience cast ballots on the resolution, we must tolerate a nuclear Iran. The results, 24% voted in favor of the motion, 48% against, and 27% were undecided. We'll now join George Perkovich making the introductory argument proposing the notion that we must tolerate a nuclear Iran.
To judge the motion, we must tolerate a nuclear Iran, you must evaluate the alternatives to it. Ideally, the United States and other leading actors can prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. Indeed, all six of us here agree emphatically that the U.S. and the international community must do everything possible, and more than it's been done already, to try to prevent this. The general point is prevention, all of us agree, is the best option. Yet prevention is not the proposition we've been asked to debate here tonight. The question we are debating is whether we can tolerate a nuclear Iran. That question assumes that diplomacy has failed and we're on to other options. The most feasible strategy for not tolerating a nuclear Iran is an attack, a combination of attacks on its known nuclear facilities, on its Air Force and Navy to try to prevent its capacity to retaliate immediately, and on the Revolutionary Guards to try to hasten regime change. Now, if I thought that a military attack of this type I described would actually eliminate that nuclear capability and do it for a sufficient time, I would be for it if the consequences of our attack were not going to leave us worse off. Voting for the motion does not mean doing nothing or turning the other cheek to Iran. Voting for the motion means deciding that another war will not solve this problem, and that a robust, extremely tough strategy of deterrence and containment would be the most effective way to keep a nuclear Iran from threatening the United States and its friends. Thank you.
Thank you, George Perkovich, for proposing the motion before us. We must tolerate a nuclear Iran. And now to the podium, we call the first opponent of that motion, Patrick Clawson.
I thought George gave a very eloquent statement of why we should not go to war with Iran. And if that were the proposition that we were debating, I think that his arguments were spot on. That, however, is not the proposition we're debating. The proposition we're debating is that we should not tolerate a nuclear Iran. That's quite a different matter. In fact, there are many things that we could do, even if Iran got a nuclear weapon, that would suggest to me that we would have non-military ways in order to persuade Iran to give up that weapon. Most of the countries in the world which had nuclear weapons have given them up, and not through war. So there are, in fact, many things that we can do that would show that we cannot tolerate a nuclear Iran short of war. And so I would rather spend my time discussing the proposition as stated to you, namely that we cannot tolerate a nuclear Iran, rather than discussing whether or not to go to war with Iran. The Nobel Peace Prize-winning head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed El-Baradei, who you may recall was no friend to George Bush on the Iraq matter, says that if Iran does what Iran announces it's intending to do, that Iran will be, quote, a few months, end quote, away from having nuclear weapon. So our real question is, do we want to see Iran have that kind of a capability? And indeed, why do I think that that is something that not only we cannot tolerate, but we need not tolerate? Let me count some of the reasons. First is that this, what the Iranians are doing is exploiting a loophole in the system that we have constructed to make sure that the world does not have 100 countries with nuclear weapons. The Iranians have correctly identified a real weakness in our system of stopping the spread of nuclear weapons. Indeed, Mohammed El-Baradei has proposed a 5-year moratorium on the construction of all fuel cycle facilities worldwide and has said that any such facilities should be under international control because the technology is so dangerous. If Iran gets away with building this, it will not be the only country. We will not only have to tolerate a nuclear Iran, we will have to tolerate a nuclear Turkey, a nuclear Egypt, a nuclear Saudi Arabia, a nuclear Algeria, a nuclear Venezuela, a nuclear South Africa, a nuclear Brazil. And when we start having 20 or 30 countries with nuclear weapons, and we start having a multiple system of deterrence, it's going to be very interesting if we have to go through the Cuban Missile Crisis another 20 or 30 or 40 times. I'm not confident it'll turn out so positively every time. Furthermore, we need not tolerate a nuclear Iran because there is much that we can do to stop it without having to talk about going to war. The fact is that Iran has acknowledged to the International Atomic Energy Agency that it's been carrying out these clandestine nuclear activities for 18 years. But they haven't gotten very far. Now, a lot of that is because of our success, in fact, in having a system which does limit what Iran can do. We have had a lot of successes in our efforts in stopping Iran's program. You may recall that we were very worried when the Soviet Union fell apart that its scientists and nuclear matter would show up around the world causing proliferation. We started a big program called the Nunn-Lugar program to prevent that. And in fact, none of it has shown up in Iran. None of it. And we can, by reinforcing our system of controls on Iran's access to advanced technology, by mobilizing the world community, slow down Iran's program dramatically. So there are always ways in which the control on technologies makes a real difference. And that's why we should continue our efforts to limit Iran's access to these advanced technologies rather than tolerating a nuclear Iran and saying, well, now you're in the nuclear club. Okay, join the club. You can do what you want. No. So we do not have to tolerate a nuclear Iran. We can get them to stop or, if necessary, to reverse.
The next speaker in favor of the motion is Sanam Vakil. She spoke about the internal domestic impact of Iran's nuclear program, and Vakil argued for consideration of the average Iranian.
Iran has been using its nuclear program to bolster its legitimacy domestically in Iran, regionally in the Middle East, and internationally. And this tactic is coming at the expense of American credibility and influence. So Tehran's message is simple. It's a regime not to be reckoned with. The U.S. is in a weakened position in Iraq, in Palestine, Lebanon, Afghanistan, and with this growing conflict within the religion of Islam. And Tehran is exploiting this to its advantage, drawing on the Arab Street for support at the expense of the United States.
In her closing, Sanam Vakil argued for a policy of engagement with Iran.
So Ahmadinejad says he supports dialogue. Let's take him up on this offer. So I leave you with this. The U.S. is losing the Iranian street. It's moving into dangerous territory in the Arab and Muslim world. And it's losing support in the Security Council. Let's take the lever away from Tehran. Let's not allow them to exploit their nuclear program at our expense anymore. Thank you.
The opposition's next speaker, Ruel Marc Gerecht, focused on the impact of our policy on religious forces within Iran, and he criticized his opponents in this debate.
First time through. But I will focus on just a couple issues which I think tend to get overlooked, particularly in American and European audiences, and that is that when I hear the other side talking about that, I hear them sort of talking about Iran as if it's a status quo country. I almost never hear them talk about God. I almost never hear them talk about the religious inspiration that still fuels the regime at the very top. And that doesn't mean, once again, that you will not find individuals in that elite who cannot be, quote, quite pragmatic. I was quite struck by the commentary of the fellow on CBS, the very, very old fellow, who went to interview Ahmadinejad, and he seemed like a very rational man. That is, I think, a very Western comment, because we have this sort of false juxtaposition that individuals of diehard belief and faith cannot be rational. They absolutely are. I think if you look at the Western track record dealing with the clerical regime, that you would have to say that we've done a very poor job of responding to them. In many ways, we have been at war with the Islamic Republic since its inception, except we have not responded. They have bombed, they have attacked, they have killed American soldiers. We did not respond. I suggest to you that what you're going to see if they get nuclear weaponry is a new inspiration. I think it's already out there. I would expect that Ahmadinejad is once again trying to do what Khomeini and Rafsanjani Khamenei had tried in the 1980s and failed. That was to lead the radical Islamic world on a new American, anti-American jihad.
This is Intelligence Squared U.S., a series of live debates. I'm your host, Robert Siegel. In a moment, we'll continue with the last two speakers, writers Karim Sajjadpour and William Crystal. That's in just 1 minute from Intelligence Squared U.S., from WNYC and NPR. Welcome back to Intelligence Squared U.S. Our third and final speaker in support of the motion is Karim Sajjadpour.
Thank you so much for coming. It's really a privilege to be here and a privilege to be speaking before Bill Crystal. It's a big privilege and a big challenge. When I was in high school, my father used to watch the Sunday morning talk shows, and my favorite guest was always Bill Crystal because he was always so thoughtful and sensible and sensitive. I just assumed he was a liberal. I must admit I was a late bloomer intellectually. I would just like to first start off by reiterating the point that George made, that I think all six of us here are after the same thing at the end of the day, which is in Iran, which is democratic, which is free, which is prosperous, and which is not armed with a nuclear weapon. That would be the ideal option. I think personally it would be disastrous if they were to acquire a nuclear weapon. But the question at hand is, should we tolerate it? And that begs the question, should we go to war with Iran to prevent it? Which cost would be higher, to actually accept Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon or going to war with it to prevent it? I would suggest the latter option would be far more dangerous. bombing Iran to prevent it from acquiring a nuclear weapon. And I'm a bit surprised tonight that the other side of the table is seeming to I'm a bit too junior to contradict them too much, but they're running away from the argument somewhat, because both Ruel and Bill are on the record saying that they would bomb Iran. So hopefully we hear that from Bill in the next round. I would just argue that if Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was here tonight, he would be arguing on the other side of the table, meaning I think he very much wants to see a confrontation between the U.S. and Iran. And indeed, this is a proxy war between the U.S. and Iran for hegemony in the Middle East, for Arab and Muslim hearts and minds. If we bomb Iran, oil prices are likely going to go up to $150 a barrel. Currently, the regime is making about $200 million a day on oil revenue. So we double that. They're going to make $400 million a day on oil revenue. I would argue that that will put them in a far better position to support Hamas and Hezbollah financially than if we don't bomb the country. And I think just if we're serious about fighting this war, which is becoming very much this self-fulfilling prophecy of the clash of civilizations, we're going to have to figure out a way to resolve our differences in the Middle East without using bombs. But I would argue that you present to the Iranian people two options, and you present this publicly to the regime. A, pursue this nuclear program unequivocally, come with me, for the sanctions, isolation, potential militarization. Or B, you take certain nuclear compromises and you re-enter the international community. You're going to have the people put a lot of pressure on the regime to change their behavior. And so far, this has not been a policy option which has been issued by the U.S. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Karim Sajjadpour, and now speaking against the motion, Bill Kristol.
I personally came in undecided, as many of you did, and even leaning slightly to the other side, but I've been convinced by Ruel and Patrick's brilliant arguments that I was put off by Karim's false praise of me for a second, and I salute Sanam for her genuine concern, obviously, for the Iranian people, who I think we all agree deserve a much better regime than they have, and I think we all agree, we haven't talked about this, deserve much more aggressive efforts on the part of the United States and other democracies, and Europe could do much more here to help them liberate themselves. Look, we should not tolerate a nuclear Iran. Three quick reasons, and a couple of them have been touched on, but maybe not developed. George says, and I think everyone probably agrees, that we have to be tougher in our diplomacy, think of us more seriously about sanctions, move perhaps outside the Security Council to get sanctions if we can, explore financial pressure to really squeeze Iran, which I think the administration is beginning to do. Secretary of the Treasury Paulson is working pretty seriously on this. That would be done, I think, outside the Security Council and through a sort of coalition of the willing on the finance ministry side. None of this, and this is all good, none of this will work unless it's backed up by the threat of force. Diplomacy will only work if there is a real threat of force, not just saying options are on the table, but a sense that we really won't tolerate the outcome if Iran does not yield, if the moderates, to the degree there are some in the Iranian regime, aren't empowered by the pressure we're putting on to prevent the headlong rush to nuclear weapons and manage to change course domestically. Diplomacy can't work without the threat of force. Therefore, it really would be disastrous to diplomacy to say we must tolerate a nuclear Iran. So whatever people might think one would have to do, and sometimes one has to do things in the real world 7 or 10 years from now, or 3 years from now, I suppose, we should not say we should tolerate a nuclear Iran, and therefore you should all vote no, just to help diplomacy along. But I'm serious about that, and I'm serious that I believe we shouldn't at the end of the day. I will satisfy Karim and say that I would bomb Iran in a pinch, but I really, it is important to not even to signal weakness. The only reason the Europeans got serious in 2003 is that we went into Iraq, that we hadn't yet encountered the difficulties we've encountered in the subsequent 3 years, and people, the Iranians were worried, and the Europeans were worried that Bush really would use force, and that's what made the Europeans much tougher than it looked as if they would have been prior to 2003. So for diplomacy to be work, we need the credible threat of force. You could therefore cannot say that we would tolerate, or certainly not that we must tolerate, a nuclear Iran. That is, I don't like to use models of the 30s or the analogy of the 30s or Hitler, but in this respect, it is like the 30s. Throughout Hitler's success at each stage strengthened him internally. He didn't start out in firm control of the regime of which he was chancellor. There were others who thought he was reckless. every time he did something reckless and got away with it, it discredited his internal critics. It empowered fascists elsewhere in Europe, and other regimes began moving in that direction. The democracies became demoralized. We ended up fighting a war against a much more powerful fascist alliance, axis, than would have been the case if we had acted much earlier. We face that prospect, unfortunately, if we let a jihadist radical regime successfully pursue nuclear weapons in the Middle East today.
That concludes the opening arguments from our panelists. Again, if you'd like to hear these arguments unedited, you can find them at our website, npr.org/Mideast. And we now begin the question and answer portion of the debate.
Is it really realistic to think that we are going to now have 10 more nations with nuclear weapons in the next 10, 20 years? And the kind of comment along with that, too, is there's an interesting vicious cycle that gets set in place when you by starting another war, you are creating this vicious cycle of other regimes feeling threatened and then spurring them on to produce nuclear weapons. So there's almost, will we be giving Chavez more of a, you know, impetus to start getting on the nuclear weapon bandwagon?
Well, since the argument of the one too many nuclear Irans was made by the opponents, let me ask the supporters of the motion, George Perkovich, to answer it. Does tolerating a nuclear Iran imply tolerating many other new nuclear powers?
Well, I mean, I think we'll come to this later. We're now confused about what it means to tolerate or not to tolerate, because, I mean, I happen to agree with everything Patrick said, because he didn't talk about going to war. I agree with Rule and Bill. We should do everything we can to try to prevent it. So if what we mean by tolerating is that we really, really don't like it, we're going to do everything we can to stop it, but we would accept living with it if that was the alternative other than war, then I think we agree. If the alternative really is what Bill said, but not what Patrick said, that not tolerating it means that you are willing to go to war over it, then I would say to your question, there's only been one case in history where there was a military effort to stop a country from trying to get nuclear weapons. That was the Israeli bombing of Iraq in 1981. And you can argue what the effects of that were various ways. Iraq went to war or was at war with Iran, and then we had another war with them in 91, and then we had another war with them in 2003, and their nuclear program continued when we didn't think it was, from 81 to 91, but when we thought it was, or some people thought it was, it turned out it wasn't, and we're there now. That was every other case of getting a country to stop involved politics, negotiations, giving them benefits, security guarantees, trade-offs, and deals. So we should be concerned about, if Iran succeeds, what happens. But the way the rest of the world's going to respond to this is going to be, if you marshal diplomatic pressure, economic sanctions, plus rewards, that's the way to do it. We don't have
Mark Gorecht, why don't you reply to what George Petrovich is saying?
I mean, just a quick comment on that. I don't think it's any coincidence that Gamal Mubarak announced that Egypt is going to have a civilian nuclear program. I think the timing of that, because of the Iranian nuclear program, was intentional. I would add that there's a great deal of suspicion that the Saudis were in part financial backers of the Pakistani nuclear program. It is impossible, I think, to overestimate the fierce hatred and competition that exists and has existed between Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic from 1979. Bill alluded to it. Much of the Islamic militancy that we see today, the fuel behind bin Ladenism, actually grew out of that competition in the 1980s. It would be surprising not to see the Saudis make some play for a nuke. And I would also add, I wouldn't at all be surprised to see Turkey go in a nuclear direction. I think the Iraq war certainly showed to the Turks they cannot rely upon NATO as an institution of their defense. And I think the animosity that does exist in Turkey, even if it goes in a more Islamic direction, which I think it will not diminish its profound suspicions of the Islamic Republic. And I think it would be a good guess that the Turks, too, would start working on a nuclear program.
Next question. Do we have someone?
Given,
could you stand up, please?
Yes. Eugene Linden's my name. Given the present situation in Iraq and Afghanistan and the possibility of $150 a gallon barrel oil, do we really have a credible military threat?
You mean, does the United States, is the a threat from the United States credible? Patrick Clawson.
In a word, yes. First off, the United States military were to take action against Iran's nuclear sites, this would be the Navy and the Air Force, which are not overly committed in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it would be quite a doable thing to destroy the key nodes in Iran's nuclear program. We don't have to flatten the whole thing, not to go in Dresden and knock it all down. We just have to knock out the key nodes. And there are some key nodes without which that program cannot function. And it would take a number of years to rebuild. And the question arises as to what would Iran's response be if we did this? Well, we don't know. It would depend upon the circumstances. But I would just suggest that there was a time when, in fact, as far as the Iranians were concerned, we did bomb them. And we did take military action against them. And that's the end of the Iran-Iraq war. When we, after all, in what we see as a tragic accident, shot down an Iranian Airbus and killed 200-plus Iranian civilians, but they saw that, very bluntly, as the United States entering the war. And indeed, in this being the Holy Defense Week, in the Iranian newspapers have been full of interviews with people about the war and how it happened. And Rafsanjani is asked, well, why did you end the war? Because America entered the war against us. So the fact is that the last time we bombed Iran, the result was within a week that the Iranians accepted a ceasefire that stopped a war which had killed 700,000 people. And we paid no price in our relationships with the Iranians. That's because the Iranian people were sick and tired of that war. And so the task is up to us to paint this nuclear weapon as the device which the mullahs are using in order to consolidate their power and their control and to keep their grip on the country. Because if Iranians perceive that what we are doing is getting rid of the tool by which the mullahs are going to consolidate their control, then it's a very different situation than if Iranians think that this is a national bomb needed for national defense.
I want to see if the other side agrees that there is a credible military threat. No ground troops, simply airstrikes. Karim.
Obviously, the United States is powerful enough to bomb Iran. That's not the question. The question is the day after we bomb Iran, just like the question in Iraq should have been the day after we bomb Iraq. Obviously, the United States could change probably every regime in the world, apart from a few, China, Russia, India. But, you know, what are the repercussions for the day after? I would argue that at the moment, even, Iranians believe that Iranian soft power is dominating U.S. hard power in Iraq. And I would just put on the table that it's fundamentally incompatible to think we're going to stabilize Iraq while simultaneously dropping bombs on Iran, not to mention other countries in the region. If we really want to try to tranquilize Lebanon, we will see a resurgent Hezbollah if we drop bombs on Iran. We want to tranquilize Palestine, have the moderates strengthen the moderate Palestinians, we're going to strengthen Hamas if we do that. I just want to make a further point that, you know, Bill and Ruel have written that it's unclear what would happen domestically within Iran if we drop bombs. Maybe actually we could over time strengthen the Iranian moderates. And this goes back to, it always reminds me of a quote from John Limbert, who was a great U.S. diplomat who was actually taken hostage in Iran for 444 days during the 1979 revolution. And he was someone, like many Iranians, my father included, who believed that when the Shah was deposed, the Shah's government would be replaced by a secular democracy. And what we saw, of course, was that Khomeini came to power. And he later wrote in his memoirs that what he learned was that when sudden upheavals happen, revolutions are not won by those who can write incisive op-ed pieces. And I think likewise in Iran, we should have no illusions that if we bomb the country that it's going to be moderates who come to the helm, whether within Iran or within the region.
Sanam Vakil.
Could I just add one more thing? If we also think about bombing Iran, you also have to think about not just nuclear nationalism that persists within the country, but just inherent nationalism, the patriotism of Iranians that they feel for their country, Iranians who don't even love the regime but love Iran, the same way that you might love the United States of America or wherever you're from. These are the Iranians that will come out in defense of their country.
Ruel Gerecht.
I don't think anyone on this side of the table believes that if we were the bombing Iran will produce a moderate revolution inside the country. In fact, I think we'd say that's really not the issue at all. The issue is, do you believe that an Islamic Republic armed with nuclear weapons is going to help the United States stabilize Iraq? I think that is not at all true, just the opposite. As long as the radical forces inside of Iran gain power, gain will, I think it is impossible to imagine a situation inside of Iraq that is going to be stable and in any way pro-American. I think you will see the forces of radicalism inside of the Iraqi Shia community continue to gain ground. They are becoming a dominant force in that society, and Iran has no intention of deterring them, and certainly Iran, armed with nuclear weaponry, I don't think would be a force of moderation inside of Iraqi politics.
Our next questioner, sir.
What are you going to do about West Europe? What are you going to do about the Europeans in terms of their support or non-support for this kind of event?
Bill Kristol, what's the answer to that question?
The only reason the major powers in Europe are as engaged as they are diplomatically, and at least talking, some of them sometimes, about sanctions on Iran is that, in fact, they were worried in 2003 that we might use force. As the threat of force has receded, as we've been so reassuring in the last year and embraced diplomacy and made clear to the Europeans that we put getting along with the Europeans, I think, unfortunately, perhaps at a higher level of priority than actually dealing with the Iranian nuclear program, they, of course, have cheerfully backed off. They're not going to be ultimately extremely helpful in this. They will not privately be shed any tears for the Iranian nuclear program, and I don't think we'll have any great rupture in NATO. We'll still have peacekeeping forces in Afghanistan. But no, they will probably not, they certainly won't be part of the mission, and they will, in some ritualistic way, probably denounce it. But if a nuclear Iran is really dangerous, and I think it is, we can't be stopped by sort of the lowest common denominators of our allies. And the unfortunate truth, I wish Western Europe were different. I wish all of Europe were somewhat different. I wish they spent more on the military. I wish they were more serious about dealing with coming threats from outside their region. They're not, and we have to take the lead.
This is Intelligence Squared U.S., a series of live debates. This hour, our topic is a nuclear Iran and whether the U.S. must tolerate it. I'm your host, Robert Siegel, and in just a minute, we'll continue Intelligence Squared U.S. from WNYC and NPR. Welcome back to Intelligence Squared U.S. We've been debating the resolution, we must tolerate a nuclear Iran. Before our panel offers their final two-minute rebuttals, we'll take one last question.
The question I'd like to ask, and Robert, you can choose who would answer it, but where does Israel and our obligation to Israel factor into this?
Patrick Clausen, to what degree is this about the threat perceived by Israel from Iran?
Well, first you'll notice that the other side continually does not debate the proposition. They debate a very different proposition. The proposition they debate is we should not bomb Iran. Now, if that were the question we were debating, it would be an interesting debate, but it's not what we're here to do tonight. The question is, do we tolerate Iran's nuclear program? And that's like saying, are we going to have the attitude towards an Iranian nuke that we have towards an Indian and a Pakistani nuke? We tolerate that. We said, naughty, naughty, shouldn't have done that, but we tolerate it. The question is, are we going to have that kind of an attitude, or are we, as Bill said, going to use instead the threat of force in order to back up diplomacy, Bill didn't call for bombs away. Neither did I, and neither did Ruel. What we call for is to have...
Let's not go far here. So, we have a diversity of views on this side, too.
But some of your teammates are on the record. On
That's because there was a wonderful commentary article by Ed Lutfak in which he said, it's not time to bomb Iran yet. It may come to be the time, but it's not yet the time. Because what we're talking about is how we can use force in order to, the threat of force in order to back up that diplomacy.
But George Perkovich, you're the pessimist about the diplomacy.
Well, but if I may say,
you're the one who's saying it's going to end up as an attack or not an attack.
That's in part because of the Israel question. And the answer is because Israel evaluates the threat to it as much worse than the threat to us, then it's quite possible that Israel will decide that it's got to attack Iran well before we decide to attack Iran. In fact, I would say that that's likely that Israel will decide that it has to attack Iran long before we think we have to attack Iran. And that's going to force the issue about what to do about this. Well, it's precisely because we don't want to be in that situation that we have got to accelerate our efforts on the diplomacy. And we can use Israel as that mad dog that we wave in front of, the threat of which we wave in front of the Europeans in order to get them to be more serious about this matter.
George Perkovich.
We don't disagree with that, that we have to accelerate and toughen diplomacy, that we don't want Iran to have nuclear. All of that we agree with. But what does it mean to not tolerate something?
Step up all those efforts.
What? No, I agree. And then if those don't fail, what does it mean not to talk? Bill says it means go to war. Rule has said it means go to war. Patrick hasn't quite said that. So I'm not clear what the resolution is.
We have a healthy diversity of views on our side. We don't insist on orthodoxy, unlike some people.
George,
you know?
You're saying don't tolerate it. You're saying take action against it. Well, this proposition is not go to war with Iran. That's not the proposition we're debating.
But what you're saying is pretend not to tolerate it.
We shouldn't tolerate it.
And then at some point, maybe you tolerate it. And Bill says,
pretend not to tolerate it first, and then this is a semantic debate.
To clarify, Patrick Lawson, you're saying worst case, if all of the diplomatic measures you're talking about don't succeed, then you'll tolerate it.
No. The only way we can make those diplomatic measures succeed, as Bill has said, is as if we say at the end of the day, if they don't, we'll use force. Because the only way we can make diplomacy work is if we say at the end of the day, we are prepared to use force. And that is what we should be doing.
But the
other side has not said about how George says we should press them. How the heck are you going to press them if you say at the end of the day that what we're prepared to do is tolerate it? They're not going to be interested in me.
Can I say a word on this? This is a semantic. I mean, look, the serious argument, the most respectful argument I would say on the other side is Kareem's, that bombing would prolong the regime, would strengthen the regime. I take that argument very seriously. Ahmadinejad successfully pursuing and acquiring nuclear weapons, in my view, would strengthen the regime and strengthen the most radical elements in the regime much more surely than bombing would. Bombing is, of course, you don't know what affects it. There is historical evidence of the use of force destabilizing and discrediting a radical and aggressive regime, and there are historical examples of nationalist tempers flaring, and at least for a while, and the radicals being strengthened. I wouldn't want to stipulate one or the other, but the one thing I think we can stipulate is letting the most radical elements pursue nuclear weapons successfully would, in fact, strengthen the regime. So I think if you care about ending the regime, which is what one has to care about, one has to be serious about saying we don't tolerate this regime, this Iranian regime, acquiring nuclear weapons, and then acting if necessary to prevent it.
Karim Sajjadpour.
I'd argue that at the end of the day, what's going to change this regime is economic malaise. It's not going to be bombing it. It's not going to be the nuclear issue. But similar to the Soviet Union, at the end of the day, you can't eat a nuclear weapon. And that's what's going to change this government. But again, I think that if we do give it a pretext to clamp down on its domestic population, it will very much take it, and we could see the prospect of change move back many years. And I would just argue as well that if we somehow were able to manage a nuclear-armed Soviet Union and a nuclear-armed China, which had far greater appetite than Iran did, it seems to me preposterous that we can't tolerate a nuclear-armed Iran in this context, in the context of deterrence.
Well, thank you both. Thank all of you very much for commenting on our audience's questions and for clarifying the semantics of the motion, or muddying the semantics of the motion. I'm not sure which. I'm intrigued by the idea that Bill Kristol came here undecided and is newly won over to the con position, which would make him a neocon. We heard earlier from each of our panelists with an opening statement that began with those supporting the motion. And we're now going to hear a brief concluding statements of no more than 2 minutes each, beginning with those who are against. And we start with Patrick Clausen. Patrick?
According to the New York Times, when Kofi Annan was in Iran at the beginning of the month, he was quite astonished in his meeting with President Ahmadinejad when President Ahmadinejad explained that while Britain and the United States won the last World War, Iran was going to win the next one. Now, Kofi Annan didn't even realize there was going to be a next World War, much less that Iran intended to emerge victorious from it. Do not underestimate the ambitions of a group which feels that they represent a quarter of the world, namely the world's Muslims. They feel that they brought down one superpower, the Soviet Union, thanks to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and that, indeed, they can bring down another. They have very extensive ambitions. So this issue of whether to allow them to have nuclear weapons is of extraordinary import to us, and that is why we should be prepared to make credible threats of the use of force. And only through making credible threats of the use of force is the kind of diplomacy that I described going to be successful. If we begin that diplomatic process by saying, at the end of the day, we are prepared to live with you, to tolerate this nuclear Iran, we will get nowhere with that diplomacy. We will get nowhere with forging an international consensus for strong actions of this kind that we have been able to use successfully to slow down Iran's program for the last 18 years. Paradoxically, only the credible threat of force is likely to prevent us from facing the danger of force. We have talked a lot about whether or not the United States would bomb Iran. Let us recognize if Iran gets the bomb, it may bomb us.
Thank you, Patrick Clausen. George Perkovich.
Again, I'm confused by the terms, because we agree with almost everything, especially that Patrick said, and with much that Ruhl and Bill said about its the nature of the Iranian government, what we want for the people of Iran, how bad it would be if Iran got nuclear weapons. And then I don't understand what it means not to tolerate, because Patrick has used the verb say. We should say we won't tolerate. He said we should have credible threats of using force, but avoids the issue of would it be our policy actually to go to war, which to me means not tolerate. Bill's clear, at least. He's saying, we'll go to war. That's what the resolution means on their side. Not tolerate means physically stop, physically try to act against. And then the question is, does that guarantee success? There is no guarantee of success. We have an experience with China. And China was getting nuclear weapons in 1964. The U.S. government was prepared to launch nuclear war against it, to destroy China, to keep it from getting nuclear weapons. Then we thought, no, instead of that, we'll give nuclear weapons to India in 1963 to balance China. We were afraid that Mao was such a revolutionary. He had killed more than 20 million of his own people, something the Iranian regime hasn't dreamed of. We thought it would be the end of civilization, that revolution would happen everywhere under this nuclear umbrella. Well, in fact, we decided that we couldn't stop China. China got nuclear weapons. Here we are today. China is a huge economic threat to us today, but it isn't like you're going to go home tonight worrying that China's going to wake up and nuke the United States, which it does have the capability to do, and which Iran, for the foreseeable future, would have no capability to do. Do I think we should publicly say we'll tolerate it and welcome? Absolutely not. But the exercise here is to try to clarify in your own mind and your own planning.
On that note, George, thank you. We will remain just that clarified and no more. next concluding statement from Ruhl Markarecht.
Well, I remember having a conversation with a good friend of mine, Jeffrey Goldberg, who now writes for The New Yorker and used to write for The New York Times Magazine. And Jeffrey had just gone over to sue madrasas in Pakistan, and he was interviewing young students. And he kept asking them what he believed in, and they kept saying to him, I believe in jihad, I believe in killing Americans. And he'd go to the next one, and he'd say, I believe in jihad, I believe in killing Americans. And he kept doing that, you know, day after day, and so he got some idea what they believed in. Now, the Iranians don't act that way, all right? They're vastly more refined. That's what makes them, in many ways, the most, and also contradictory. That's what makes them, I would argue, the most interesting people in the Middle East. But do not make a mistake. This question, this debate is about what is at the center of their spirit, and they are dedicated. They are dedicated to the jihad against the United States. They are the mothership of much of the Islamic radicalism that we have seen, and what is striking about the regime in Tehran is that it hasn't become more moderate. It hasn't, in fact, gone into a period of thermidor. That the moderates that everybody has hope in, and I have hope in them too, have been stuffed. And that you do not see them coming forward. You do not see them gaining power where it matters. It is great and wonderful that the average Iranian on the street is, in fact, becoming much, much more moderate. It doesn't matter. What matters is the people at the top, and they have not. And I sincerely suggest that you do not want people like that who believe they represent God on earth and that they represent the vanguard for all Muslims to have nuclear weapons.
Thank you, Roel Marc. Correct. Now to one of the most interesting people in the Middle East, Sanam Vakil.
I appreciate Roel's comments that the government of Iran is the vanguard of leading this one-fourth of the world into jihad. But that's not the government that I'm aware of and that I have been studying. Many people in the variety of camps of the regime, Ahmadinejad's ministry as well, told me repeatedly that it's the constant threat from abroad, regime change, threats from the U.S. administration that have been coming from the past 4 years, threats of sanctions, containment, isolation of this regime that are perpetuating these fears within the Iranian regime. So consider that when thinking the Iranian mentality. There are two ways of going forward. We have the military option, but we have an option that has never been actually pursued. 27 years of isolation, there's a wide gulf. Why not actually try direct engagement with these crazy folks? And let's see actually what they might do. If we're actually dealing with them one-on-one, bring them close, make your enemies our friends. We can monitor their nuclear program. And oftentimes, there's a lot of talk on the Iranian street that the hope of having America back in Iran will actually stimulate the Iranian people and recharge them. And that might be the way to perhaps lead to a prosperous and maybe even hopeful Iran in the future.
Thank you, Sanam Vakil. And now we'll hear from Bill Kristol.
Really just 3 points, proliferation, terror, and jihad. The proliferation threat here is unlike that of when the Soviet Union or China acquired nuclear weapons. It is very likely that Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Algeria would decide they would want nuclear weapons if Iran had them. I don't know that we could stop them. We could offer them security guarantees. It would be safer, I think, to prevent Iran from becoming nuclear in the first place. We are talking about an extremely dangerous arms race in the most volatile region of the world. That was not the case when previous nations went nuclear. India, Pakistan, a little bit more like that, and Pakistan was the worst one to have allowed to go nuclear, but now this is Pakistan squared, so to speak, or cubed or something. Second, terror, providing a nuclear umbrella for terror is not something that's been done. The Soviet Union played with terror and did some pretty bad, funded some pretty bad things, but has nothing like the intimate relation to terror that the Islamic Republic of Iran has had. And people need to think seriously about what a nuclear umbrella over terror acts with the possibility of giving nuclear weapons to terror groups, but also protecting terror groups by a threat of nuclear retaliation, what that does in the Middle East. Here, Israel, I think, becomes a central question. And how does Israel then react to terror groups protected, so to say, by an Iranian nuclear threat of retaliation? Finally, jihad. Patrick and Ruel have made this point right. This regime getting nuclear weapons would be the biggest booster shot for jihad, and I think both on the Shia and Sunni sides possible. That is the threat. The jihadists need to be, those on the wavering need to be convinced the jihadists are losing. Letting this regime get nuclear weapons would convince too many people, unfortunately, that they're winning.
Thank you, Bill Kristol. And lastly, Karim Sajedpour.
Well, I think one thing that's been missing tonight is Iran's ambitions, Iran's impetus. We've talked a lot about what the U.S. is thinking, what Israel is thinking, but we can't look at Iran's ambitions in a vacuum. I would make the argument that it's not that they want to pursue nuclear weapons to wipe Israel off the map. we try to get inside the head of Iranian leaders, they say, well, this revolution of ours happened 27 years ago, and to this day, the U.S. has never recognized us. And look historically at countries that have pursued nuclear weapons. It's not been for offensive purposes. It's been very much driven by senses of insecurity and defensive purposes. I would just invoke the paradigm which many on the right in the U.S. have invoked when it comes to Iran, and that is one of two ticking clocks. So there's the regime change clock, and there's the nuclear clock. And the idea is that you have to make the regime change clock in Tehran expire faster than the nuclear clock, so when the day comes when Iran actually weaponizes, it will be under a more friendly, democratic Iranian regime. Now, the fundamental contradiction of this policy is that when you try to expedite the regime change clock in Tehran, you send the message to Iranian leaders that, in fact, the United States is after a regime change approach, and therefore you need to pursue a nuclear deterrent. So we have to get these clocks worked out. Is the goal to prevent Iran from going nuclear, or is it to change the regime? If we continue to try to do both, that's going to be Iran's greatest impetus for pursuing a nuclear weapon.
Thank you, Karim Sajjadpour, and thank you to all six panelists for your very ardent contributions. And that concludes our debate. Now, after the debate, the audience was again polled on the resolution, "We must tolerate a nuclear Iran." Overall, the debate did not change the opinion of the audience. Only 34% voted in favor of the motion, while 49% voted against. But it is worthy of note that while the opposition won the debate, the proposers, that is, those who believe we must tolerate a nuclear Iran, gained more ground, picking up 10 percentage points. The winning side, opposing the motion, held steady in their popularity with the live audience. If you missed part of this debate, you can listen to the full discussion or download an audio file at our website, npr.org. You can also learn more about the Intelligence Squared debate series and get a schedule of the Intelligence Squared events. Go to npr.org/Mideast. The Intelligence Squared U.S. debate series is an initiative of the Rosenkranz Foundation, Chairman Robert Rosenkranz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. The goal of Intelligence Squared U.S. is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. Please visit the Intelligence Squared U.S. website at www.IQ2US.org for more information about this new live debate series. This series is produced for radio by WNYC, New York Public Radio, producer Rob Christensen, senior producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Edward Haber and Damon Whittemore. Intelligence Squared U.S. is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.